The theater. The theater.
Hang out, Louis.
Theater. Theater.
To be or not to be.
Theater. Theater.
Hi, friends.
Oh, yeah, friends.
How you doing?
It's so good to see your faces.
Yeah, right.
How you doing? Did y'all ever watch Wendy Williams? Fuck with Wendy Williams?
Nah. Do you know what? I saw a lot of her clips on when Joel McHale used to do The Soup.
Sure.
And
sure,
she
sure,
was
sure,
a
sure,
lot
sure,
of fun to watch.
Sure, mm-hmm. sure, 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 sure. Remember
and
The
then
Soup?
She disappeared.
Remember The Soup? Remember it was originally Greg Kinnear?
That's right.
I've got a hot take on that too, on Joel McHale. Okay. It is the only thing that I enjoy watching him in. Like, as an actor, I'm not crazy about him as an actor.
Community?
He works in Community. He works in Community because he fits the cliche that he's meant to be.
Sure. Right.
But that's like the same with everybody in that show. Anyway. I love that show. CJ, you said you had something. What's
yeah, it? I think I brought it up a couple weeks ago. The day after Halloween, I had the pleasure of getting to catch an event called Walk with a Mall.
Oh, yeah.
And it is a 12-foot tall puppet of a 10-year-old Syrian refugee girl. Yeah. And she has been taken since like 2021. She has been taken all over the globe. And she did a U.S. tour this year, and she was in like four or five locations in L.A. I heard about this on one of my favorite podcasts, Political Gab Fest. I was like, I got to check this out. And she just happened to be stopping a mile away from my apartment, and it was at 7:30 in the morning. And I got up and I walked down to the UCLA Community School, and it was such a cool fucking event. Like, I had a great time. It's a really cool school, but it ended up being very emotional too, and I ended up staying longer than I thought I was. And then the other fun part about it was I posted about it, and then I had friends that saw her in other locations of the city, like in the next couple days while she was in LA, and I think she was in Pasadena. So for the rest of the year, she's in Mexico, but I just wanted to shout out anyone out there that might be interested in it. The website is walkwithamal.org, and yeah. I'm sure there's going to be more tours, but it was free, and it was just... It was really cool, and it was, I love Koreatown, I love this part of LA, so I was just glad I got to participate in that.
For
sure.
That's
yeah,
rad.
That's amazing.
And I feel like we gotta do an episode on puppetry, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, we've got plenty of friends that build it and work with them all the time,
yeah,
so,
sure.
Yeah.
I took this really, I was in a show in college, directed by Spencer Lott, who now is a puppeteer on Sesame Street. And at the time, he was really into Tabletop and Bunraku, okay? So I did this show. It was called The House of Atreus. And it was the story of the lineage of Atreus. And it was told where we were all the gods. And then the humans were Tabletop puppets and Bunraku puppets.
That's crazy.
And we made the puppets ourselves and like three people to one puppet to run it.
Yeah,
but it was
yeah.
the kind of like John Malkovich kind of, being John Malkovich type of puppetry where it's like the head is just slightly moving to
right.
me. And like, you know, like very, you know, not marionette, but like.
Right. I know I've told y'all about the Faust I saw that had Mr. Bean in it.
Rowan Atkinson and Faust.
There was Rowan Atkinson. There was no actual speaking in it. Everything was recorded over, and it was just his mouth moving, and he was the only human, and everything else was a human-sized marionette puppet.
Yeah.
It was the most, and there's a lot of creepy claymation. It was one of the most fucked up things I've ever seen. But
you ever seen Lion King?
Oh, yeah.
On stage?
I saw it a long
Roddy,
time ago.
You seen Lion King?
Yeah. I've just been quietly sitting, listening. It's like I'm hearing the podcast before anyone else does. This is great. But yeah, I love Lion King. There's also a show that I was able to catch on like Broadway HD, so you can see it. But it's called The Tin Man, and they have...
I love The Tin Man.
Right? It was so much fun to see. And like,
or The Woodsman.
Oh, you're absolutely right.
The Woodsman. Yes, but he is The Tin Man.
But
yeah. Okay, yeah.
And like you start with a real guy, and you slowly but surely revert to the puppet. And like just how they did that with like, you know, three or five people was just so cool to witness.
Scott, you talk a lot about the Oz books and how they're kind of messed up. And this is that story of the Tin Man, like chopping off each of his
limbs
and becoming a puppet slowly but surely. It is beautiful. It's on Broadway HD. I'll check it out. I recommend it to people. But what else is puppetry but theater?
I mean, right? Yeah, absolutely.
Listen.
Right? Yeah. Am I wrong?
No.
You're not.
Speaking of.
Yes.
Yes.
Welcome to Theater, the theater podcast for theater nerds, made by three theater makers from the LA theater scene. I'm J. Bailey Burcham.
I'm CJ Merriman.
And I'm Scott Leggett.
Yes. And each week we get together to discuss and debate the definition of theater through various lenses. And this week we are honoring and celebrating something that we've only done twice.
Yeah.
Okay. Last year was our first year, our inaugural year of this award, the Theater Playwright Award at the Hollywood Fringe Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And last year, our winner was Maddox Pennington.
Yeah.
We stan a legend.
Mm-hmm.
They're a phenomenal playwright who also had a show in this past Fringe. And
a show that we covered last year.
Which we covered. So then people got to listen to the episode and then go see it.
And the TGNC festival that St. Fools just did.
That's right.
They had a plan there.
But this year we're very proud to honor a local writer, producer, and set sound and prop designer. Whoa.
Yes.
And the founding member of Zani Theatrics. Roddy Viegas was born and raised in Northridge, California. Yeah, am I right about that?
Yeah.
After graduating,
You seem unsure.
He's like, really?
Yeah, I was caught off guard. Yeah.
Yeah. After graduating from CSUN with the coveted Valera scholarship, no big deal.
Oh.
He has taken the LA theater scene by storm. Most recently at the Hollywood Fringe Festival 2023, where his play Infierno won multiple awards, including the Playwright Award, sponsored by this very podcast. Another legend who we stan, and we're overjoyed to have him with us here today, Roddy Viegas, everyone. How are you, Roddy?
I'm doing great. That was fantastic. I was like, where did you get all this info? And then I realized I need to update my bio on the website.
You do.
It's incredible.
You do. But I decided, you know what? I'm going to do a little digging. And I found the CSUN article about the Valera Scholarship. And I was like, word. And that had all the information. So I was like, cool. I'll put that all in there. And then I'll let you tell us everything else. You can update us on what else is going on. But let's start here. What is your story? What is your? How did you get into theater?
Yeah.
All
tell
that.
Us everything.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Well, born and raised in the Los Angeles area, North Hills, real close to Northridge. And I tried to do a couple different things in high school. That was very tactile, things with my hands. I loved like just baking or cooking or pottery. And then I landed, you know, having theater to always come back to, landed in scenic design. And then kind of around like junior high, I was like, okay, I think I want to do theater. So I think I'm just gonna do that for the next forever.
Right.
And I kind of never stopped. I didn't feel like, I wasn't like, oh, I should try something else. I was like, no, this is it. I'm happy doing this. This is incredible. Yeah. And just being to explore every single facet, or almost every single facet of theater, whether it comes from like writing to scenic to directing. Like, there's so much that I love bouncing back and forth around. And then I just haven't stopped I haven't stopped.
Take a breath. Yeah, good. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it, because that means you love it. And it means you're one of us.
One of us. It's true.
Yeah. So real quick, tell us about Zani Theatrics and this company that you have started.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it started in 2019, but a lot of it and how I view it has changed so much. So it started in 2019. We launched with a production called Death Inc., which I wrote, and then I was like, you know what? Freshman year of college, I want to produce this, and I don't know how to produce. But there's nothing like trying.
Yeah,
right.
Trying,
you
figure it out.
A lot. You just gotta dive in. Yeah.
And so I went for it. And after that experience, I was like, I want to do more things. I want to produce more works. And I was hoping eventually that they wouldn't just be my works, but they'd be other people's works that, like, we were able to, like, help them create scripts they're passionate about and foster that and, like, develop it to not the end-all, be-all step, but just, like, one notch so that they can go take that piece somewhere else and keep workshopping it. But at the time, in 2019, I was like, well, I'm going to keep doing work. Might as well keep it under a company name. And then, so I was on a 13-hour train ride reevaluating the company recently and thinking about what I wanted it to be. And so much of it was like, no, I just want it to be a platform for other artists to come in and create and just attempt to assist them as best as we can. And giving that them a platform. And I'm not saying I have a huge platform, but it's like, you know, it's a little stage and we'll do stuff and we'll have it get seen. But really, it's just like fine tuning things that we want people to eventually go on to do more with. Like, we have these radio plays, which we'll talk about later, that, like, we brought in writers, we brought in actors during lockdown, and we're like, let's just create and see what happens. And sometimes we'll get notes on scripts, or we'll have, like, little rehearsal processes, and that was something great to, like, keep a hold of. But then again, we do, like, cabarets in October and July, and we, like, try to present people who are working on new materials, such as, like, comics or singers, and then all that fun stuff. So it just became a place to, like, I want to provide a platform, which is why I, which is a great segue, right? Because why I adore Fringe, because it's like, that is the one fantastic accessible platform to, like, produce work on a budget. Because I've done it a couple different ways now, which I'm, like, stoked to say, but Fringe was just such an accessible way of getting to put work on its feet.
And, how many times have you produced at Fringe?
This was my first time.
Cool.
Yeah. And it was a great process because, like, so in, I want to say, like, it was like 6 months before January, because that's when the scholarship submissions were due. I had this idea that I'd been wanting to do for a while, which is, like, try to create a modern adaptation of Dante's Inferno. I've been reading it a lot during lockdown, and I thought it was just so, and I'd read it in high school, and even in high school, I loved this really darkly comedic thing about it. And so I when I graduated, I told my department chair, who's at the time there, it was AJ Kim, Ajong Kim, phenomenal person. And I just love, like, updating them on everything I'm doing, and they're always very excited to hear. And so I told them, like, I'm thinking of writing this. And they're like, you should present it at Fringe. And I'm like, I love that idea. I will absolutely, I'll go for it. And then I heard about the scholarship that happened, and that was all to be due by January. So I submitted all that. And then I heard back not long after. And yeah, Fringe was like, we'll, the part of their built-in scholarship, like, we'll provide you a platform, a space to create this. It wasn't a matter of, like, what's the script about? It's like, why are you passionate about creating the work? And what is the work highlighting? Because the scholarship aims to highlight underrepresented communities and their stories, in part. That's one of the facets of it. And
maps to Hollywood Fringe.
Yes. Oh, my God. Props to everyone. Ellen, Lois.
Ellen and Lovelace.
Ellen and Lovelace.
Incredible. No, they're so cool.
They're the best.
But, I have a meeting with Lois tomorrow. I'm so excited.
I'm jealous.
Lucky. I just got to wait till office hours to say hi again. Yeah. I'll be missing. but yeah, anyway. And so then at that point, like, I had a rough draft of the script, because I wasn't going to submit without having a script finished. But, from January to June, the script just had some major reworkings. And, this is why I loved the last episode, because you guys were talking about process, and it's just really interesting to pick someone's brain. And so, with this process of doing the script, it was different than I had done, like, with Death Inc. and with other works. And I purposely try to keep changing it up just to seeing what's working, what's not, what's more fun, or not keeping it stagnant and, like, trying to mix it up. And I really just loved how it came out. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That
rules. Well, why don't we get into it? Let's talk about Inferno a little bit. Yeah. So this is the winner of our award, this play, not just you, but the play, and the presentation of it. CJ.
Yo.
Do you have, by chance,
yes,
a breakdown?
Yeah, you fucking bet I do.
Fuck yeah, let's do it.
Nice.
CJ's breakdown.
A modern theatrical retelling of Dante's Inferno. Dion, a troubled writer, faces the ultimate death of his brother, familial issues, his own addiction, and ultimate death and thereafter. I have to admit,
yeah,
this is my first ever Inferno. Because I had bought the book and it was sitting in the backseat of my Pontiac Grand Am for years. And people would get in my backseat and they'd be like, why do you have Inferno in the backseat of your car? And I'd be like, I'm going to read it.
Divine Comedy.
Going to read it. And it's, alas, it is on my bookshelf and I have not opened it up. But I am very fascinated by the whole hellish, I love to talk about Hieronymus Bosch type shit. So, yeah.
You never had to read this in school?
I went to the shittiest motherfucking public school in the world. We didn't read anything worth reading.
I forgot.
Yeah.
I had a roommate in college who that Dante was his on the shitter book. So it took him the whole year.
He'd finish and start back over.
And he would march in, you know, proud as could be every day with his copy of Inferno.
A year is good time because that book is dense.
It's like, so that's a dense.
Big book.
How often? Really, you know, yeah, yeah.
It really
that's how
depends.
Bailey got through that Poopin. Ibsen play.
Peer Gynt. I had to put it next to the toilet. That's the only way to finish a play like that.
It's like, what's a line from The Big Chill? Jeff Goldblum's like, I'm tired of writing things that people read on the crapper.
Yeah.
Well. It's like, well, people read Dostoevsky on the crapper. Yes, but they can't finish it.
Yeah.
And it's like, but yeah, no. Yeah, it is dense. And it also, I think, really depends on what translation you get. Like,
sure.
Like, was there a specific one that appealed to you? Is there a specific one that you were like, ooh, I'll extract, or did you use multiple versions?
Yeah, so I definitely use multiple versions, because I started with a... Because, yeah, that was the thing. I was like, well, I don't know Italian. and I was like, right, so I was like, I'll just find whatever looks nice on Amazon. I'll be like, what will help me? And then I realized after purchasing it, I was like, this is great. This is really dense. This is helpful. I need help digesting this. And so I think it was one of those like No Fear Shakespeare.
Yeah,
type.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that I was like, I need assistance. I need that to look into that. But also like, so, cause it was the thing, it was like, I used Dante's Inferno as the guide, but I'm sure we'll get into this, but with every single level of hell, we're kind of tackling something different. And for the process of writing and then trying to research all of it, it would be a different book I would have to like dive into or read or select the chapters I wanted or look up what I needed. Cause like, I know I have a couple books now in my shelf about like madams of the 18th century, I believe. Yeah. And like trying to understand that world and trying to understand the historical events and the people, which mm-hmm. isn't, it was so hard to find one. I found a perfect book, specifically in San Francisco, but like this, of the time period in San Francisco, but the book was out of print and I had to like, thankfully Amazon has like secondhand deliveries of like, you know, oh, this place in Arizona has this copy. And I'm like, I would love to purchase it.
Non-spawn, have you ever tried thrift books before?
Yeah, thrift book rules.
I think so. I'll have to look up again, but yeah,
I get all of my books.
Go down,
it's great.
Download that app.
It's great. You won't be sorry. Anyway, I'm sorry I interrupted. Go on.
No, absolutely.
The Redwall franchise here.
Yeah, thrift books is the best.
Oh, yeah. Brilliant. Oh, that's awesome. But yes. So so I started with reading Dante's Inferno, and I was trying to read it chapter by chapter or like section by section because in the beginning of Dante's Inferno, it's very clear cut. It's very like accessible to read. Like, okay, here's this level of hell, here's this punishment, here's the main thing, here's the main idea you can play with. And so, again, starting with lust, it was like, how do I? Because I want to transform it, I want to change it, to update it to a modern like sensibility or a modern view. Mm-hmm. And so it was like, okay, I want to specifically for lust. I had an already established concept of subverting what lust was and who was in there, but it took forever to like figure out the the punishments, so many of the punishments were a lot harder to think of. But finally, I think it was reading somewhere that it was like a storm that's punishing in that level. And for some reason, in the previous version, I was like, what if it's set in like a Vegas-y place and it's the desert? And none of that made it in, thank God. But the only thing that stayed was sand.
Yeah.
And it was a sandstorm and just kind of attacking the flesh, which I thought was really interesting as an idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not fully, I'll just immediately credit this Miranda Barrientos, the phenomenal director that she is. I absolutely want to tell you more about her and how this process was, because she was very instrumental in the process, because she this is how my brain works. We bounce everywhere, so this is gonna be fun.
Yeah, this is how this podcast works.
Right? but Miranda is phenomenal, and she was actually someone who was, before the play was finished, reading scenes, because Miranda's also just been an incredible creative partner to work with. And so we worked previously where we directed a show together with a group of four directors at CSUN. And the way both of us communicate, she is a far better communicator, but she just understands what I'm saying. So it's amazing.
Right.
But she was able to, like, she was getting live updates as well as a couple other people, which is really different in this process. I hadn't had that in Death Ink. I was just kind of solitarily writing. And once the script was done, I went to get feedback. But it was Miranda Barrientos, our director, Sam Barrientos, our stage manager, Leah Villegas, my sister, and Alejandro Jimenez, who it was in the cast and is also a part of the company, who were kind of reading it chapter by chapter, scene by scene, and occasionally giving feedback or just saying, give us the next scene, what happens next. And it was so beneficial in that writing process to just see, like, oh, here's the next step of the way. But also, after every single step, because I knew I wanted Colin Cabeza to start, which are these men with golden kind of colored glasses in the show.
Right.
And they kind of, at first I wanted them to be a sort of Greek chorus, but it's really hard to do a Greek chorus. And so they just kind of became an audience surrogate for the very beginning. And it was just incredible to see them play around. But after
they introduce us to the sort of unhinged nature of what we're about to see.
Yes.
Right.
And to me, it feels a bit like, and now we're speaking mostly to people who may not ever get to see this show. Well, let's not say that. This show will be massive someday and everyone will see it. But what I really mean is, like, we might be speaking to people in Poland who, you know, will not have a chance to engage with this. And so, like, what to me was very, very interesting about it is because at the beginning, Dion is, you know, pretty obvious that he's maybe taken some drugs, he's taken some whatever. So these entities end up introducing us to where we're headed, both energetically, but also it's introducing us to, like, what's in his mind is sort of how I took it at first.
Mm-hmm. Well, and a recurring theme.
The director did that very well. Yeah.
Right. And a recurring theme I have noticed in your work, Roddy, is the whole idea of taking something serious, like you're watching someone kind of ruin themselves at the top of this, and that's very depressing. And then you bring in something kind of crazy and fun and funny, and it's this whole idea of if you don't laugh, you're going to cry. Mm-hmm. And it helps you keep moving through the piece. So,
never mind. Yeah, just the facing of mortality. The journey into hell, the journey into those levels and those punishments, like you had a great, what's the word, valve release. As things started to get just that point, and whether that was theatrical element, whether that was the movement, I loved the staging of the whole thing, whether it was the music or anything, like it was and not necessarily funny stuff. It wasn't like, yeah, you had some wacky dude coming out and doing bits,
right.
But it was just enough to take the foot off the pedal so you could get around that the turns of it. Is what I admired so much.
Which I'm guessing you don't get in Inferno.
Well, it's the quote unquote divine comedy, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it is, yeah.
I guess I need to read it.
Do you? I don't know. Just watch Inferno again. Honestly, it's the same shit. I like it because it to me, really, it's like, well, actually, we'll get to that later. I was about to go into a whole take. I'm not going to do that yet. So get back to what you were saying. So specifically Miranda and her work on this. I really loved like the stuff that y'all did with the because Fringe limits us so much. Mm-hmm. And all the performances were spot on and fantastic. Dion specifically, and also Dante, I thought were like two like pretty phenomenal performances. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about Dante later because I have a whole thing. I kept saying this to Scott and CJ through the whole thing. I was like, mm-hmm. Dante is Buster Keaton. Yeah. I'll get this. but I really admired how you used so little to still be so theatrical, specifically with you had bookshelves. There are these two bookshelves that would move apart from each other, and in between the bookshelves were this tape, light tape,
whatever
you want to call it, right? LED tape. And it would turn on, and the, you know, the elevator music would play as you would travel down into the levels. And I was just like in heaven. Like, it was the start of Fringe for me. I'll give a little bit of context for me. I went in. It was I think it was the first show I saw at Fringe.
Oh, it was one of the first ones. Wow. No, it was supposed to be, and then I couldn't make it that day.
That's right. Yeah, this was the first show I saw at Fringe, and I was like, Fringe is gonna be awesome. You know, like as I walked, I was like, this is the Fringe. You know, but so then I was just talking about Inferno for the next month. Talking to Scott and CJ. They didn't get to see it till way later.
Right.
So I kept being
think
like,
we saw
no,
the last show.
Yeah. And it was sold the first out.
It was great energy.
I remember just like sending you to the emails being like, I'm working on getting you a ticket. It's going to happen. I'll catch you in there. No worries.
Right. I remember that. I was like, you guys got to get there. You got to get in there. And they're like, okay.
Bailey was being very aggro about it.
I was aggro. I threw a beer at one point.
Yeah.
Battered it against the plunge wall. I was so angry. Miranda, you were speaking about Miranda and the process, and we interrupted.
Yeah. No. All good, because there's so much to talk about. It's so exciting. Yeah. But Miranda, yes. So in that beginning couple of scenes, I knew where our introduction would be. I knew where the kind of sandstorm lust level would be. And then after that, I had no idea. And normally how I've done like previous work, smaller or larger, I've done the beats. I even did note cards once and had like a stack of 40 note cards and said, oh, here's the play. Now it's just time to write it and wiggle room within the rest of it. But for Inferno, because it was so much dependent on, or I wanted to depend so much on looking at Dante's Inferno at the beginning, because obviously if you name your play Inferno, you gotta give them something. You gotta be like, it's we gotta be faithful to some extent.
Yeah.
That doesn't last for long after we get down to the middle section, but we can talk about that in a second.
Sure.
But that was such an interesting scene, especially because early on, that lust scene would be one of the scenes that would, there are two main scenes in the play that would have the most rewrites done to it. And lust was one of them. And Miranda and I just kept going back and forth on just what these notes were before the actors came into the room. But one of the biggest was, and something that I'm always at fault of, is like just writing dialogue and forgetting about action, being like, the directors can handle the action, but like allowing there to be something, which then in response to that, I wrote the next scene, which is of our three men in Gluttony. So we throw in, which you don't actually really name them, but it's J.P. Morgan,
right.
Carnegie, and who's the other guy?
P.T. Barnum,
yes.
You don't name them, but we get it.
Like, yeah.
I'm like, oh, it's P.T., like right away. Like,
in a very Stygian witches from Clash of the Titans.
Yes.
Wow, yeah.
Which was so much fun. And then, so as a response, it's like, let's throw as much action as possible into this. But, and then we reeled it back in. But it was a matter of like, it was so exciting to have someone who I like respect so much give me feedback as a director and in response to the writing before the show has been put on. And just going back and forth and being like, what does this level need? What is it lacking as a scene? What is it missing that you would, as a director, want to be in there? And just working on that. But then in conjunction with that, it was always, okay, I have the next level of hell. let me read that chapter, let me read that canto in Inferno, and then what do I pull from it? And just who do I throw in there? Because, like, how much of it stays true? How much do you want to subvert? And so every single time I would be looking at, like, okay, as we jump past gluttony and go into greed, which is a whole other thing, but Plautus, and this is a character I've really fallen in love with, just like as an idea. Plautus is a big demon in that chapter, in that section of the book. And I was like, okay, let's bring him in here, but what is he going to be tackling? And of course, greed just came to mind as so much of the, like, media I was digesting at the time. And just current events was about, like, the pharmaceutical industry, and everything that entails, and
pharmaceutical music man of hell.
Yes, that was a really good description.
Demon Daddy's little Spitfire. That's yes. also yeah, yes, love
yes,
it.
Yes, yes, yes.
And yeah, it was a wild time to bring that in. All while this whole narrative of hell itself and world building, which I adore, was happening, I was like, wait a second, Dion, what's your story? What's his deal? What's going on? And that was a whole other thing where I didn't realize, because I knew the ending, which we'll get to in a second, but like of the song and this big moment of catharsis. And I knew I really wanted this specific song because I just felt that it was everything. But I didn't really know what Dion's place was. And I didn't even know how Dion would work within the story, which is insane because he's the main character.
But that's always the problem is, like, is it a whole play where some things are just happening to a person?
Yeah.
Or is it a play where this person's choices and engagement with the characters actually matter? And that you know, you've crossed that well. You've done that well to make it more that and not just things happening to a quote-unquote protagonist.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so in doing that, what I didn't intend to, but I really was glad that it was kind of a stepping stone for what comes next, is Dion was this Latinae character who was becoming a Latinae character. I didn't know what his background was at all, but just kind of noting these events and very much attaching facets of myself to Dion and trying to bring this connection, because I think it's so fascinating, because there is some Spanish in the play, and there's mixed in with the English.
I would call it a bilingual play.
But
it's well communicated. There's never a point. And now I took Spanish, so I might not be the correct person. Right, I speak enough that I can understand it. But I think most people, even because I talked to people afterwards, most people were like, "Yeah, but I got it."
Right.
Yeah.
Like they were like, I don't speak really Spanish, but I understood. And I was like, yeah, it was very well communicated. I think that's half the writing.
It's like
half
Shakespeare. It's in the performance. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't have to understand every single word that's being said.
Yeah,
but if you've got a good director and good performers, then it comes across.
Anyway, you were saying.
Well, just touching on that, because that was a big concern of mine, not of the cast or the director, because they knew what they were doing and they had full confidence. But like in the back of mine, I was just like, how is this going to be received? Because you are correct, it is fairly bilingual, and so especially with our scene with Dion alone, it's this moment of like, how much Spanish am I willing to give? But also in the play he has a resistance to the language, to that part of his culture, which just writing that, all of that Spanish and some of it being imperfect and leaving it imperfect was really important. My background is a Salvadorian Mexican-American. So it was interesting to see some of the cast members who would ask questions about certain, especially with the first scene, because Colin Cabeza also speaks Spanish, and we give them a couple of Salvadorian-specific curse words.
Oh, cool.
And they were like, is this a real word? And I'm like, I'm almost certain it is. and we were also debating, like, well, do we change it to like more personal curse words from like other countries where they have different responses that would make the actors feel like, oh, having ownership over that. But in the end, we kind of just maintained the course of this background of like a Salvadorian Mexican-American background. And playing with these languages. But yeah, it's so interesting because there was for Dion Cene speaking it out loud and attempting to see what felt natural, but what felt natural wasn't what was true to the language, wasn't like what was correct grammatically or anything. And it was just like an interesting idea to have this character speak this language as best they can, but it is what they feel in the moment. It's the language that's true to them. It has the biggest impact. And I do it in my daily life. There's moments where I'll speak in Spanish and English with family and friends and things, and talking in different tones and playful or whatever. But there's something that, I don't know, lights up in my brain when you get to really high intensity emotions that sometimes English isn't enough, and you switch on to Spanish, and I'm able to communicate ideas, because there are certain words in Spanish that, for me at least, have more impact than their English counterpart.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And it's, that was
a thing of like when listening and seeing the audience's response to those larger Spanish dominant scenes. We would have people that said like, yeah, I didn't necessarily understand it, but I got what was going on. But there were also some very few people who were like, I didn't understand it. And I felt disconnected, and it was unfortunate, but it was something that I was like, okay, how do you workshop this? Is this something that you do? It's just, you know, Fringe allows you to ask those questions and see where your piece goes. But I realized like, okay, there, especially in that Dion scene, even if I translated all of that Spanish into English, not only do these words not have the same impact, but also so many of these sentences and what he's telling has so much iconography in it that he's talking about that is specific to a second gen narrative, where, okay, you could have heard it in English, but you still wouldn't have been able to connect with exactly what we're talking about.
Right.
Sure.
Whether that's talking about specific foods that are eaten in specific times of year, like pozole, or we talk about Catrín La Dama. I mean, we live in Los Angeles, which is phenomenal because that some more of that is accessible and understandable.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That iconography. But it was that interesting idea and realization when I was talking with people months after the show and just asking that question again and realizing that, no, if I translated all of it, it's still, you still wouldn't necessarily connect with it because you don't have those experiences. Mm-hmm. But there's still so much weight because obviously Dion's saying it, and we know it matters so much to him. And people who people with a Latine or second gen background will also resonate with it on a whole nother level. But it doesn't dismiss how anybody else interprets it. It just means there's more text, subtext to that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would tell you don't ever fucking worry about it. As the show evolves, as you take it to next levels, as you do another production of it, don't worry about it, because it does. It absolutely rings true. And I think that's, and maybe it was because we are in Los Angeles, but there's that energy that came along with that. You know what I mean? Like we go walking in any neighborhood in, you know, any of many neighborhoods in the city, that's what you're going to get. I understand half of what's being said, but I actually understand 85% of what's being said. I get it. I understand what's going on. And I think it's a compliment to the whole cast and the direction that the moments were real. The moments felt theatrical and impassioned and thoughtful. And so you're just in it. Whether you get it all the words or not, as, you know, English speaking only peoples.
Absolutely. And I know that the cast was at first, you know, because we had that rehearsal process, and some of them felt very confident in their Spanish, and others were like a little wary. But it was again about just practicing that Spanish and getting it down. But oh my God, I just wanted to use this as a little segue to talk about the cast, because like they're amazing. Sure. So the play deals with about maybe like 15 to 16 different characters. I lose count, and yeah. Dion never changes. Like he isn't double cast, right. And Dante isn't double cast, which means you have about four to five other actors playing, you know, four or five other roles.
Right.
And in the theater we were in, those bookshelves were backstage.
Yeah, right.
That's all it was. We were installing hooks and baskets on the bottom. And luckily there is some space in the back with a curtain that we were able to utilize. But when we moved it around, when we went to Jack's Theater, We we just had to like make sure this show could be moved there, and how does that backstage work? And it was so much fun to see them make these incredible choices to do, you know, just make every single character its own, and it was such a big ask, and they just killed it. Like, they were all of them were phenomenal. Yeah.
Yeah, they're incredible. And it's like, it's such a fun, you know, as an actor, I'm always like, I want to play as many roles as possible. Mm-hmm. We're dealing with this right now. I'm doing Richard II at Shakespeare Youth Fest, right? And there's like 500 little, you know, senators and whatever friggin', you know, things. We're also doing Julius Caesar, so it's the same deal. So these kids are coming to and they're like, why am I playing so many roles? I'm like, this is the opportunity.
Yes.
This is what we're all begging
Go
for.
Be bold.
I'm watching Infierno going like, shit, I want to do that. Yeah. It's fun. But I want to also pivot a bit to, well, the actor playing Dion is incredible. The actor playing Dante.
Yes, Vittoria.
Phenomenal. What's their name?
Vittoria.
Vittoria?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
I absolutely... Okay, so... Okay.
Let's get into it.
Yeah, because... So for the first time you see Dante... I didn't get to rewatch it. I just reread it. But the first time you see Dante, you see right away that he has... his mouth sewn shut. Mm-hmm. Am I correct? Yes. Okay.
Yes.
So when I first saw it, I don't know what you did, but it looked good.
It looked real good.
Yes,
like
it looked
like
someone
has sewn this poor actor's mouth shut. And she was okay. So anyway. What did you do? I have to know, actually. What is it?
We sewed their mouth shut, actually. Yeah.
That's what I thought. We
got the needle. We got the thread. well, we kind of. It was way less painful. It was a prosthetic, right? With some makeup there. But we would use, what is that kind of rope? Twine. And kind of place them there. So truly, Vittoria could not speak, or else it would rip off. And I had the coincidence one day of being in rehearsal and standing in for them and just seeing that moment of like, okay, let's just pretend I'm the character, I'm them, let's make some choices. And so many things of like, oh, I want to open my mouth, I want to say something, I want to look like I'm about to do something and get stopped. None of that was
Can't
viable. And I was just like, this is, and then to see them perform it and see everything they're doing, Yeah, I think Buster Keaton is such a incredibly flattering but true description
take.
Of it. Yeah. You're
That's
incredible on that.
So,
yeah.
So what's magic about Buster, right? One is that he wasn't a pedophile and the rest were.
Right.
The second thing that makes him great is that he was pure stoic, right? It was always to the point of like looking sad. A bit
stone
right?
face, yeah.
Stone face. That is who he is, and doesn't use his mouth when he does expression. He uses his eyebrows, and he, you know, uses those big jowly cheeks, but he doesn't really use his mouth. And so all of a sudden, you have a character that is having to be very physical to communicate, and this is what Dante was for me. And it's you know. Solidified by the fact that they are communicating with index cards,
yes.
which are then super titled above, projected above the actors, mm-hmm. okay? Which you don't do for the Spanish, but
right.
you do for Dante.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, yes,
mm-hmm.
correct. Theater, right? I'm like, mm-hmm. this is correct. So, and it's like you're watching an opera with the super titles. You guys ever see opera?
Oh, yeah.
All the time.
Yeah, it's the best. But I fell in love with that conceit very early. Like, the first thing he hands over is, like, an index card that just says, like, sure. Or something that, and you're just like, oh, no, that's how they're going to talk the whole time. But then you even, like, when he first introduces himself, he has to, like, find the index cards. And they're like, and they do this like kind of, you know, if I'm remembering correctly, again, I didn't
no,
get
no,
to
No, that's
rewatch.
Spot on. No, absolutely.
I just remember these really specific movements, which I'm sure were built with the actor and with the director and with you and like whatever. And so commend you all. But I fell in love with that right away and then was with the show. Like, that was the moment I was sold, was when I realized what you were doing with that. And then I was never off board.
It also just reminds me of simplicity. Like, one of the first exercises I had to do in freshman year acting was we had to create a scene that was us walking into a room and finding something and leaving. And when I think back to what I did for that, I'm surprised they didn't fucking kick me out of theater school.
But it's just, you just decided this is now a cut program. Goodbye.
Yeah, I mean, it used to be a cut program. Right. I don't know how I got in with my quilter's monologue. The whole idea of simplicity, you don't need to do a lot to get things across. And then again, I did this when I took a master class with Ellen Gear a couple years ago. We were supposed to come in and tell a story about like the first, or how we got to LA or something. And we stood up front, and the second we started using our hands to tell the story, she would say, stop, put your hands down, start over again. And it just became this thing over and over again. And the whole idea was people waste so much with their motions, with their voices even at some time. And it's just, you don't need it. And that's what I loved about that character too. It was really honest because it was so simple.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it adds these levels of comedy beyond even just the physical of just like Dion trying to like get something out of this. You know, like trying to have a soundboard in the elevator and just getting nothing, you know, like just really, really hilarious. I don't know. I feel like we could talk. Well, let's talk a little bit about the ending, because there's so much. Yeah. There's like actually, first, P.T. Barnum, that's like one of my favorite parts. The fact that you chose those three people. Mm-hmm. Are you a fan of Greatest Showman? We just have to know. Inquiring minds want to know.
I think that there's a lot of fun about the creation of that piece. Do I think we could have chosen a different... Why?
Say how you feel.
I just like, I don't need a story about P.T. Barnum. If you know who he is, he doesn't need his anthem. I think there's also another musical. It doesn't.
There is.
And I think
there
the is. Other musical, I vaguely know about it, but I don't think it paints him in like the best light, which I'm like, cool, that's fine.
The other musical's kind of good, because it's like, he was kind of a bigot, and you're like, whoa. And he cheated on his wife, and you're like, shit. Yeah. It's like rough,
The cheating would not be the highest on my list, because I think he's done a couple other really terrible things.
Way worse.
Just
things.
The exploitation of other human beings.
Well, right. and the original musical, the first musical, has a whole, which I think is Candor and Ebb or Comden and Green or somebody.
Yeah,
it's someone
like that.
Great.
Yeah.
And there, it even like admits like also all of the animals died in that fire and some people too. And it was really awful. And in Greatest Showman, he's like, damn, all right, well, let's move on. And you're like, no.
We'll start over. It's like, no.
Let's do another pop song with the words dreaming in it 50,000 times.
I love it.
This is the podcast you've all been fucking waiting for. Oh, God. Sorry, Roddy. We don't mean to taint your
episode. We hate that movie.
This garbage.
No, there's a reason why he's on that level, you know?
Thank you. Well, because that was my point, is I was sort of like, good. I know you're on our side, or you wouldn't be in the gluttony.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And we could go level for level. We really could. But I really want to push people to, is there a way to engage with this online? Does this digitally live?
I'm glad you asked.
Yeah.
Zanni Theatrics has a website. It's ZanniTheatrics.com. So I've made it easy.
ZANNI.
Correct. Right. Yes. Okay. And not only can you find a recording of it, because we filmed the show, David Haverty recorded for us on, I believe, closing night, which was so much fun.
I remember him being there.
It was a wild time. Closing night was wild.
Yeah.
But so much fun. And just David did an incredible job shooting it. I edited it together. It's now, you can purchase it and get a YouTube link, as well as, I mean, you'll see there that Death Inc. is also there if you really want to see where all this kind of started. But that's for the next episode, I guess.
No, we'll never talk about it. It'll never happen.
Works with me. That's okay. It's a little outdated version.
Yeah.
But yes, absolutely. By all means, you can see it there. Or if you want to go down to San Diego in May.
Oh,
are you awesome. Doing? Are you doing San Diego Fringe?
Yes, because that was one of the.
Oh right, very that's right.
Yeah, like yeah. Thrilled. That was a wild night too. The closing night of Fringe. I did not know because it's the first Fringe. I don't know what's happening. Yeah. And so that was like so eye opening, so exciting, so thrilling, so a lot. And I remember just ending that night in tears in the car, thrilled, happy. We weren't sad tears, but I was like, it was so many phenomenal emotions. But
you
Sandy,
were crying because I had my fly down when I presented your award to you. That's
what did you?
I ruined the night. Yeah, I found out later when I saw a picture. And I went, guys, no one fucking told me.
I wasn't looking down there.
That is
well,
so
you
funny.
Should have been.
Why?
All of you should have been.
On. Hey, Bailey. I'll check your junk every time.
Scott and CJ, you're my junk checkers. Thanks.
Junk checker. Oh, J actually stands for junk checker.
Oh, you saw it?
I did check it, and Scott, I didn't say anything.
You?
No, of course not.
You?
Backstabbing.
Saboteur.
Well, I wanted everybody to enjoy your junk. That's all.
I will say, and I wanted to thank you this because you did make me cry, Bailey. Actually, I during closing night we were talking about a little bit about the show, and you know, so many very kind words, incredible, and I thankfully I was like, okay, this is very kind, like just stay in the moment. But what broke me was you mentioned you said you just said what a well produced show. And I immediately started tearing up, and I was like, wow, because I adore as one of the things of like a scenic and directing, but I adore producing, and I adore all the little intricacies and planning that goes into it. And of course, like, your audience may not always know what goes on into the production, but because specifically with Inferno, I had my fingers in so much. I had it in the scenic, the sound, the projection, the play itself. To like get to that moment and just receive recognition for the production as a whole, like just as it was produced, I just want to thank you because that got me. I was like,
well,
my God,
it was great. And Scott and CJ know I'm an asshole about production. I just am. If it's not good, I'm gonna be honest about it. I have a lot of problems with it, and I think Fringe, unfortunately, especially with people who have done a lot of Fringe, it begets. Yeah. Bad production.
What? It's just Fringe. It's Fringe.
It's
yeah,
Fringe.
We're fringing.
It's like, we can have beers while we rehearse and just fucking... And I'm like, yeah, okay, but what if, you know, you treated it like a real production? And I think watching shows like yours with a group of people, Attic Collective is another one I want to shout out. Attic Collective and Zonic Theatrics are two theater companies that I think are like bringing life to Fringe again and being like, hey, but what if we're like producing real shit and not just like... slapdashing things together for fun because we want to make some things with our friends. Now, you're still making some things with your friends, but you're doing it on
but
a level that...
Good.
Yeah, you're doing it on a level that makes me, in a good way, like, a little jealous, and makes me, like... You know what I mean? I'm like, oh, yeah. I want to be part of that. Like, oh, can I join? You know? And that's good. That's what I want. That's what I want for the LA theater scene. So, yes, it was a phenomenally well-produced show, especially for Fringe. Because we're just all jaded at this point. So.
I'm not. I love Fringe.
But again, like, first time newbie, like, adored Fringe beyond a shadow of a doubt. But hearing things about, like, oh, and about the set, like, at one point, because I was like, I know I'm going to build this set. I know that these LED strips, they're not plug-in. They're battery-operated. Like, we bought these little RV batteries, like, little to-go guys, and connected it. So so the rolling wouldn't get in the way, wouldn't disrupt when the elevator bookshelves rolled in and out.
Right.
But then I started to hear more and more about Fringe, and I was like, I think I've made a set that is really big.
Well, that's the thing, too, is it was surprising. We came in, and we were like, damn, they're having to get that in and out every night. That's a lot. But then you think about it and it's like, well, it's two big things and a table. That's pretty much what you have.
Yes.
And those, if you have ways to store and keep them, then it's okay. You know?
Right. And that was like, so on the first couple of showings we did, we realized, okay, the set, and we had two crew to help us cause we're like, this is a lot. Yeah. what got us though was, oh, there's a lot of costumes and a lot of props because going back to the scene with P.T. Barnum and all those guys, they have opera glasses. There's bouncy balls
there's
coming out. There's a this table that I'm recording on right now is the desk. It spins around. It has a another credit to Miranda is like we utilized, and I love this about props and scenic is when it's utilized in every single which way possible, and yeah, like one of these drawers opens out, comes out, turns into a game parlor type thing. Like it's matted with green. You can play with it. One of the drawers opens up, and you have sand booze for lust, and it kind of turns into a bar. But
really well thought through.
Yes, and moving towards the ending, because we also spin this table around. But the kind of thing where we realize like, oh wow, Miranda nailed it. Was this desk became a coffin, and it's like we've seen it in so much like comedic context. This piece. Mm. That to then see it in this context was, oh my God, like a gut puncher to see it transform in that way just by the relation of like where the other actors were and with the story she was telling in that moment. That is not in the script. I had this moment of like, oh, there's a funeral scene happening in the background, but it's much more theatrical of like a dancing umbrella type thing. And Miranda kind of just put out what it was. And I'm so glad that she did, because that moment while Dion is listening to the voicemails towards like the penultimate scene in his face off with the devil. Mm-hmm. And we hear much of the story of his background, his family and his relationship with everyone, to have that happening in the background and kind of replaying that moment was something that I just thought was ingenious. It was so, like you're saying, CJ, like simplicity. It was there. We didn't need a bunch of stuff. In fact, we kept cutting costume pieces from that. Like at one point I think they were wearing white gloves and we're like, we don't need the white gloves, we don't need a lot of this. And I think it just became like people had coats on and there was a rosary. Is that what they called the beads? The rosary.
Yeah.
And that was kind of it, that we got it and you kind of immediately recognize what was going on. I really loved that transformation of that scene. I thought she did a phenomenal job.
Really smart. Yeah. Talk to us a little bit about the hat dance.
Yes. Sorry. Like so much in the process. Cause it is a hat dance. You're absolutely correct. But so
right?
much.
Wouldn't
of,
it, I, no, wouldn't no, I, couldn't I categorize yeah. that as,
oh, okay, you're okay. absolutely right. I just like forgot. Cause, I didn't see that scene. Cause, every Wednesday I'd be going to office hours and then I'd be doing other things.
Cause it's not in the script. Am I right?
The dance is in the script. It's not specified what the dance is.
That's what it was.
Which,
okay.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And so often in rehearsal times, I wouldn't be there. I just remove myself. I want them to create. I don't want them to be. I don't know. I just don't want to be there for a little bit and let them do what they need to do.
Yeah.
So I saw it like close to tech, and I was really starting to like. I was just really starting to just watch it as an audience member before it happened. I'd be giving Miranda all these notes, which really weren't notes. It was just like high praise, being like, "This is awesome! This is so cool! When did you do this?" And I was like, "Well, you weren't here the other day." I was like, "Oh, you're so right." But it turned into the hat dance, and again, a lot of this play is bridging the gap to a first gen experience to a second gen experience, and it's. You're having these things that like are still maintained in your life. And I mean, this is all Miranda's doing. So for my personal experience though, like I went to I have some cousins who do a lot of the folklorico dancing and the hat dance occasionally pops up as one of the dances in the roster. And so I would have these experiences of going to like Knott's Berry Farm, they would host. And so they'd like do a school trip and I'd come to support and see those things being presented and just being these really cool moments of significance or trying to tap back into or create new memories. So when I saw the hat dance, I was just blown away. Like I completely Miranda and the actors.
Whoever I saw it with, I think it was Kristen Boulay, maybe friend of the pod or someone, whoever I saw it with, we were like tearing up during that.
Mm.
Just like, we were just like, theater, oh God, you know, like it was really phenomenal. But so that was sort of one of the final moments I really remembered from the experience of seeing it, that just like kind of transcended Fringe for me and had me hold on to it through the, I saw like, what did we end up all seeing? Like each 40 something plays.
Yeah, I think I saw like 42 or 45 shows.
Jesus. And we saw some great stuff, to be clear. All of our nominees were incredible. We're going to be doing episodes on each of them coming up. And I'll mention
that later.
So excited
for that.
But this was like, it was just one I held on to from the first day. Like I said, I think it was the first thing I saw at Fringe this year. Wow. So really phenomenal. You're a very existential playwright, specifically about death and purpose. We'll learn way more about that next week. Your first ever, you said this is your first ever full-length play, but that technically there was one before that, but we don't talk about it. So I'm going to ask you about that on the next episode.
Oh, yeah, 100%. 100%.
Okay. Perfect. Is there anything else you guys wanted to say or ask of Roddy before we spotlight some LA theater?
No, I just thought that Fringe show was so tight and so cool.
Yeah.
And like you said, Roddy, it's everything that Fringe should be about. It was a little risky. You're throwing some dice, like, you know what I mean? And, to pull it off and pull it off, quite frankly, elegantly, like the production value for a Fringe show was fantastic. And it was a great evening.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, to me, it speaks of the power of the play that it was one of the first things that Bailey saw. And then even after all of the other stuff he saw, it was still one of his favorites. And for me, it was one of my last. And by that point, I was like, man, I really smashed things in a bad way. I've been drinking too much. I haven't been sleeping enough. But then this one, like, it turned me up. And it was like, I've still got really great stuff to see. So, yeah, I'm so glad I didn't miss it. And I'm so glad we've gotten to talk with you about it.
Yeah, 100%. This has been super exciting because, like, engaging in these conversations and talking about that, not only, like, every single time I've talked about the script, which I won't say happens a ton because it's like, you know, we're all busy. But you start to say these things out loud and you start to realize them to yourself. Like, you talking to yourself for a little bit in your head, you don't realize all these things that are going into it. And you have these out loud conversations. You're like, wait a minute. Did I just say that? Is that what I, okay. This piece is revealing more to me. Like, as just,
I
you
do
just
that?
Talk about
yeah.
it. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Have your Urkel moment. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, amazing. Are you planning on producing something at Fringe 2024?
Yes, hopefully more than one thing, but who knows?
Yeah.
Hopefully things I didn't write, because that's what I'm really stoked about.
There you go,
about.
Okay. Cool.
That's hopefully it. Otherwise, I got to write something.
Right. Okay, word. Well, we can talk more about that next episode, and we can talk more about a lot more things. I'm going to ask you about your favorite play, your favorite playwright, your favorite movie, theater experiences, all the shit. It's going to be so much fun, and we'll talk about your other works. You guys want to spotlight a little bit of LA theater?
Yeah.
That sound good?
LA Spotlight.
I just want to give, I've shouted out before, but check out Broadwater LA on Instagram and Twitter. There is a crap ton of stuff happening at the Broadwater, which is a theater complex that has four performance spaces. And a great bar.
All this talk of bars is making me want a small snack.
But there's just a ton of stuff happening between now and the end of the year. Improv, sketch, full-length plays, one-person shows, cabarets, variety shows. Just check it out. Just go on Instagram and check out broadwaterla.org and come out and see some theater. Have some drinks.
Woot, woot. Siege?
No, by the time this is released, I will be in between working on shows. So, no, not at the moment.
Nice. I believe you have another weekend or two to see Barber of Seville at LA Opera, which friend of the pod, Corinne Chewy, is in.
Yes. You mean Professor Corinne Chewy?
Excuse me. Prof?
She's now a professor at UCLA. Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. What I meant. UCLA. Sorry. Fuck the Trojans, go Bruins. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. That was a joke.
I didn't know we were going to get political.
Welcome to football.
I did not know we were going to get political.
I know nothing about the Bruins. No, my brother went to USC, so I'm actually not even supposed to say that. Pete Carroll wrote his recommendation letter to the American Film Institute.
Oh, wow.
Because he filmed for the football team.
Nice.
Yeah, so I'm supposed to like USC is my point.
I guess.
I like them. They're great. That's all I have. Thanks for joining us. Is that all we got? Yeah, thanks for joining us for this incredible episode of honoring and celebrating Roddy. And we will be back next week doing the same thing, covering some more of his work and just him as a person and get you excited about things to come. And then after that, we're doing a CJ's pick, which is what, CJ?
It's going to be White Christmas, the old white musical Christmas,
the
movie.
The whitest Christmas.
And it's coming out. It's coming out the week after Thanksgiving. We're going to get y'all cooked and ready to go for the holidays, y'all.
You know what that means. More Joe Dorowski. I'm going to have my review.
You're going to make us do it.
Come on. Yeah. Gross.
He rules.
Yeah. So I'll riot.
I think I'll riot about White Christmas. No, it'll be fine. It'll be great. I actually like the movie. It's the stage show I want to talk about. That
I only want to watch the movie with y'all and have some.
That's
hot cocoa
all we're
going to
watch.
Something.
I will not engage with that stage show.
Okay, fine. Then we won't. Okay.
I will not.
Not until we watch all of Nonsense.
No.
Now listen.
Hey. No.
Hey.
No.
Meshuggah Nuns.
Meshuggah Nuns. I looked up the plot of Meshuggah Nuns the other day because I was bored. Uh-huh. And I looked it up and it said, it literally was like the best thing ever. We have to cover it. So it's about, they get stuck at a community theater that is producing Fiddler on the Roof. The nuns get stuck and they're producing Fiddler on the Roof. But they all get, the whole cast of Fiddler on the Roof gets sick except for Tevye. So the nuns put on a cabaret with Tevye about loving each other, even though we're different. Oh. It sounds great.
Okay, yeah. That's great.
God, I'm force feeding you nonsense.
Will
it's
not.
Gonna be amazing.
I'll be sick that week.
I will not be forced.
Well, thanks for joining us. We'll see you later. But CJ.
Yeah, do y'all have questions or comments? Please reach out to us via email, Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Scott?
Thank you, CJ. A big shout out to Ryan Thomas Johnson, who writes our theme song and our stingers. And our theme song and our stingers are better than your fucking theme song and stingers.
Bitch.
Suck it. And then finally to the great award-winning playwright Carol Churchill, who writes every single one of our episodes, but she doesn't even know it. One day, Carol Churchill, we're going to buy you a beer.
Yeah, or you could buy us one. I mean, you're rich.
Yeah, she probably makes way more money than us.
I do want to shout out that Roddy sent us an email that said, this email was written by Carol Churchill.
Yes.
Well done.
Yes, I know.
You're the best.
Well, yes.
We'll see you guys later. Subscribe, rate, review. It really does help. Roddy, we thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, what a pleasure.
Thank you.
Do you have anything you want to plug coming up in the next week?
This was in the wrong section, so I'm breaking
this will
rules.
Be posted this Sunday.
But Awakening is one of the equity houses, but like Spring Awakening's still playing at East West Players, and I worked on building the set. So it's really cool. I'm excited. I got my tickets. I'm
right
excited.
On.
I've been singing that today, actually. I was singing Touch Me earlier, which I think is the best song on the show. No big deal. Maybe I should sing that as my closing out song.
Yeah, do it.
Yeah, do it.
Touch me just like that. And never felt that God like, oh, that's so nice. So wander down where the fix lies. Oh, that's it. All right, my baby just walked in. I gotta go say that. Right, we did it. Good work.
Later, everybody.
The theater. The theater.